Hello and welcome to season one, episode two of the Future Urbanism podcast with myself, Neil Slotnick, aka Future Urbanism. Hoping all the listeners are well and your relative kind of lifting of the lockdowns has been going well for you all. I think Monday in the UK, we're going to get some new directives so I can meet six people in a park, something like that. But as a good friend of mine, Mark Nicholson, said, it does feel a bit like if I'm wearing red socks, I can do certain things. If I'm wearing blue socks, I can't do certain things. So I'll await future direction. Anyway, I just want to say a huge thank you for the feedback from listeners for season one, episode one on number stations. There's been some absolutely superb feedback. There's always something in the back of my mind where things that I find interesting, like, for example, number stations, maybe don't kind of transmit across to the general public and to the kind of casual listener as much as I think that they might. But the feedback has been superb, and really want to say thank you to some of the listeners from a Facebook group that kind of is about number stations. And I posted it up there. It was a bit of a punt because, you know, you're going into an arena where people know their stuff. And I kind of took it from quite a layman's perspective, and I was quite worried about getting called out on, you know, errors and erratum, stuff like that. But the feedback's been really positive. I don't know if, you know, as I said to you on episode one, I'm not really up on the kind of etiquette of podcasts. Do we talk about analytics or not? But I'll be checking the analytics that the listens have been all over the place. So, yeah, thank you so much for the feedback. The other thing to clear up, I've had a few people asking about the music that I've been using on the trailer for the podcast and on episode one. So I've referenced a couple of artists, Niccolo Machiavelli, aka Jark, and it's time to kind of hold my hand up that, yeah, actually, that is me. So am I dining out on past glories? I don't know. But between about 2013, 2015, 16, I was quite prolific in releasing techno, dubstep. You know, if you Google Niccolo Machiavelli techno, Jark techno, it's all out there on Spotify, Beatport, places like that. But to be honest with you, I just feel like the music that I made actually frames the podcast quite well. So I'm not putting it in there at all for kind of, you know, gratification or trying to pick up my own music career profile. My music career is very much done. I don't have the kind of inclination to really record any more music. But I like to listen to some of the stuff that I used to put out. And as said, I think it frames us all quite well. So, yeah, there we go. Now, I just want to give a quick content warning. This episode, I'm not going to tell you about what it's about yet, but a content warning, there is going to be a bit of swearing, and if I'm going to be totally blunt with you, there is also a little bit of animals and their death sounds, okay? Now, before I go into what this episode's about, I want to kind of frame it with what got me into the subject matter before going into the descriptions. So I am quite into a program called SAS Who Dares Wins. Now, people tend to suggest that kind of commercializes laddism, violence, all the kind of Band of Brothers stuff. But to me, yeah, the physical stuff is cool. I like watching people jump off cliffs and all that kind of stuff. But what gets me is the kind of psychological aspects of it. And just finished off this evening, the latest Celebrity edition, and just I always said to my girlfriend as I was watching it that the guy, if you've seen it, Tony Bellew, the boxer, who's just absolutely fantastic, he was never going to make it in the final stage because he wouldn't be able to take the kind of interrogations and what they did to the contestants. And as said, he did go out, not for the reason that I thought, but what gets me about SAS Who Dares Wins, and that kind of popularizes what this show's all about, is the use of noises and sonics in that final bit to disorient candidates, putting them in stress positions, and then playing them like What can we even say? Babies crying, dentist drills. So that kind of says it all. What I want to talk about tonight is sonic warfare. I want to talk about the use of noise, frequency, tone, sonics in the combat arena, and just how we can use noise to really disorient people and cause physical and mental harm to them. The inspiration for this episode of the podcast and my interest in sonic warfare comes from an author called Steve Goodman. He's a Scottish guy, and if you're into kind of dubstep and foundation dubstep and history of dubstep, you might know him otherwise as Code 9. He was way big, he is still big. He partnered up with Space Ape, rest in peace, Space Ape. And what he's done, he wrote the book Sonic Warfare, Sound, Effect, and the Ecology of Fear. Now, if you know him from his dubstep guys, he was the founder of Hyperdub, one of the kind of seminal early dubstep labels. He brought through acts like Burial and DJ Rashad again, another RIP. The man's got a PhD in philosophy from the University of Warwick. He's written that book about sonic warfare. If you want to see him, I mean, you know what you need to do. He's a lecturer at the UEL, University of East London, as a lecturer in media production. You get yourself enrolled. I mean, I'm kind of thinking of doing it myself just to hear him talk. But what he's talking about is something called sonic warfare. And sonic warfare is the use of sound and frequency and tones as a means of, as he says, setting fear, of dread, of torture, and the weaponization of sound. Now, at the most basic level, sound can actually cause you physical pain. And I'm not talking about listening to like the Little Mix's latest track or Barry Manilow. I'm talking about using extremely high power sound waves can disrupt people's eardrums. I'm thinking about my own time, you know, back in the 90s. I mentioned it on that Fantastical podcast, going to somewhere like The End, standing by the bass bins, and you'd come out at 5-6 in the morning and your ears would be ringing, and you kind of dine out on that. You'd be like, oh, the next 2 days chatting to your mates, oh, my ears are still ringing, I listen to Groove Rider playing this track, blah blah blah. But you know, that's not good when your ears are ringing. And again, I'll reference my friend Mark Nicholson, really good friend of mine, hoping to get him on the podcast soon. The guy suffers with permanent tinnitus. And, you know, whatever that was about, you know, however that was being caused, he was a DJ, he was back into clubbing. Maybe it was the exposure to those bass bins, those high-level frequencies that has caused that. But we know then that sound can cause pain and disorientation. And at times, sound can incapacitate a person. Now, the general idea is that even less powerful sound waves, and we're talking about kind of your sine waves, your kind of low-level frequencies, can cause discomfort or nausea. Think about when you're in a dentist chair, you've got a dentist drill popping. It's psychologically going to cause you harm. The use of these frequencies to incapacitate people has occurred both in special operations via the military, in crowd control settings as well. So sound, more so than a bullet, than a missile, than a whatever, is a very serious tool in any government's armory. And sound can be used. I mean, I used to, as I said in my first podcast, I used to live in a place called Hornchurch on the district line, right the way down on the, you know, going towards the Essex borders. And the Hornchurch train station used to have issues with kind of young people hanging around. So the TfL, Transport for London, bought in a device to kind of disperse young people. And what they installed was a magnetic acoustic device called the Mosquito. And what it did, it broadcast an ultra-high frequency blast at about 19 to 20 kilohertz. and that teenagers and people under about 20 were really susceptible to. Your hearing at that age is good, all right? So you can probably hear that sound kind of coming through to you, and you think, that's causing me a bit of discomfort. My ears are ringing, I'm going to go. But people of my age, you know, 40 years old or whatever, because our hearing deteriorates, we couldn't actually hear that frequency. So that kind of mosquito didn't really cause us any grief. But the young people loitering around the station, doing whatever it was that they were doing, they would be dispersed. So again, another kind of sonic weapon for you. And the other thing to say is that sound can actually affect your heart. So there's been studies around, and again, Google it, kind of sound effects on heart. These have said, and this was in tests in mice, is that prolonged exposure to kind of a certain frequency, ultrasound, can cause you intestinal damage and heart damage. This is somewhere between 700 kilohertz and 3.6 megahertz, and your heart rate patterns following this kind of exposure to sound has resulted in serious issues like atrial flutter. We can call this a heart murmur, arrhythmia. Basically speaking, sound can put your heart out of sync. And if there's one thing that we know, the heart needs to be in constant sync. Sound can have its dodgy uses, and I'm going to go for a Wikipedia special here. This is a totally unproven element, but there's something called the brown note. Now, it's a hypothetical, totally up in the air, infrasonic frequency that can cause humans to lose control of their bowels due to resonance. There's been no kind of actual test on this, but basically speaking, the name relates to the color of your bodily emissions, or whatever you want to call it. Now, frequencies supposedly involved in between 5 and 9 hertz. You can't actually hear it. It's below the common limit of our ability to hear. But yeah, it's such a rumble. It's so deep that I suppose in kind of a combat way, the ability to cause your enemy to literally, I don't even know what to say, poo themselves is going to be quite an asset for a government. Sound has been used in various conspiracy theories. There are a lot of people that describe themselves as undergoing electronic harassment or electronic torture before committing crimes. Among these crimes are mass shootings. Now, I've got four that I found around the internet. You got a guy called Fouad Abdo, Ahmed, 20-year-old guy. He took two hostages at the St. Joseph branch of the Texas State Bank on August the 13th, 2013. He took both their lives, then killed himself. A police investigation subsequently concluded that he'd suffered from mental health issues, but he heard voices and paranoid schizophrenia. He'd accused the family of his ex-girlfriend of implanting a microphone device of some kind in his head to broadcast frequencies that caused him to do what he did. Secondly, September the 16th, 2013, Aaron Alexis shot 12 people, injured 3 others in the Washington Navy Yard. He used a shotgun, and he'd written on there, "My elf weapon." He was taken out, but the FBI concluded that Alexis suffered from delusional beliefs that he was being controlled or influenced by extremely low frequency electromagnetic waves. Number three, in November the 20th of 2014, Myron May shot and injured 3 people on the campus of Florida State University. He was killed by responding officers. Before the event, he'd become increasingly anxious that he was under government surveillance and he was hearing voices pumped in via the government. And the last one, Gavin Eugene Long, he killed 3 police officers, injuring 3 others in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, was a believer in numerous anti-government movements and conspiracy theories, but he was also a member of a group dedicated to helping people suffering from remote brain experimentation, remote neural monitoring of an entire human's body. So once again, buying into that belief of sound waves controlling thought processes. Mm-hmm. Now, a bit like the first episode, what I want to do is I want to talk about three, and I call them case studies, that teacher in me coming out. But I want to go through three examples of where sound has been used to kind of cause something kind of torturous or some kind of discomfort. And I suppose that the kind of big one is going to be Waco. Now, I remember as a kid, I would have been 13 in 1993. Even in the UK, we would get live feeds of what was going on. And Waco, Texas was huge. It was David Koresh, the Branch Davidians, versus a number of institutions that I'll list for you in a minute. Well, actually, maybe two, but yeah, they're pretty big players. So what can we even do to start this? You got David Koresh and the Branch Davidians in a compound. There's a really good show. I think it was an HBO thing? I don't know. It's floating around somewhere. You can find it online. But the FBI stormed the Branch Davidians compound. This was in 1993. And all they were doing, they were looking for firearms. But what actually resulted from there, and there's so much footage on YouTube, was a 51-day standoff between the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, then the FBI and the Branch Davidians. Now, there was a lot of negotiation. There was a lot of kind of posturing to and fro in. There was a lot of smoke grenades. There were tanks. But one of the key things for me was the music, the sonics and the sounds that were kind of pumped in to the Branch Davidians. And there's a lot of speculation that actually, in order to kind of go against this, David Koresh, who, and again, I'm going to go on what the internet says, was a fouled rock musician, would fire back. So when he got a bit of sonic warfare being fired to him, he would fire back with a bit of rock music, potentially his own, but who knows. But in an excerpt from the New Yorker, a survivor from the cult side called Doyle wrote that the music from the FBI was absolutely constant, coming through massive, massive speakers. And the kind of quite interesting choices from the FBI were rabbits being killed, music that was warped, Nancy Sinatra singing "These Boots Are Made for Walking," Tibetan monks chanting Christmas carols, and telephones ringing. There was that noise of rabbits being slaughtered. One of the amusing things that I find about this, and there is nothing amusing about what went on, but something a little kind of minutiae that came out, is that The Guardian UK reported that the US military may actually owe royalty payments to the artists whose work was played to the captives. I've got no clue if Nancy Sinatra has actually got her royalties for "The Boots Are Made for Walking," but who knows. But this all comes down to psychops, all right? This is psychological operations, something used by many militaries around the world. The purpose of psychops is to influence, reinforce, and demoralize your opponent to secure your objectives. Psychops is seen to be a planned operation to communicate select information to foreign governments, groups, organizations, and bring about behavior change. And this was used in the Vietnam War, pumping messages in to the Viet Cong, just saying, your time's up, you're gone. Why don't you just go? Die, motherfucker, die, motherfucker, die. Die, motherfucker, die, motherfucker, die. Die, motherfucker, die, motherfucker, die. The second example is where to even start with this, but it's at Guantanamo Bay, and it's the use of music. There was a few years back, a Senate kind of intelligence committee report that came out about torture types in Guantanamo Bay. And obviously there was some mad physical torture. There was waterboarding, sleep deprivation. I'm going to say it, you know, if you look on, if you Google it, there was sexual assault, there was really horrific pictures that came out from the guards and what they were doing. But it also detailed the CIA's use of sound disorientation techniques. And what the CIA were doing in Guantanamo, they were blaring music at the detainees 24 hours a day. And yeah, one of those was the Blues Brothers Rawhide. So the report says that CIA records indicate that in the CIA interrogation of Ramzi bin al-Shib, the Blues Brothers rendition of Rawhide was played frequently. The records state that bin al-Shib's reaction of hearing the song was evidence of absolute psychological conditioning. Bin al-Shib knows when he heard the music, where he's going, and what's going to happen. And to be honest with you, I'll go through it in a minute. This is how and why the CIA were using some of America and the Western world's most beloved iconic songs as instruments of torture. Now, coming to the detainee side of things, detainees there were kind of interviewed, and they said that we were kept in complete darkness, we were shackled in isolation cells, there were loud noises, there was music being played in, there was a bucket to use for whatever we needed to do, and the music was there to wear us down, to break us. But also, there was a suggestion that the music may be turned off, but then pumped in to let the detainees know that another interrogation, another waterboarding was about to kick off. Now, Rawhide was well cited as kind of being the ultimate torture technique. But in 2008, Mother Jones, a really serious website for kind of information, interviewed a number of ex-soldiers and detainees, and they listed another few tracks that were used. So we've got Dope, Die, MF, Die. And if you listen to the track that I'm going to play, you'll realize what MF means and Take Your Best Shot. Eminem, White America, and Kim. My favorite, Barney and Friends, the theme song, I Love You, You Love Me. Imagine that put through some kind of filter or vocoder and pumped at you day in, day out. Drowning Pool, Bodies, Metallica, Enter the Sandman. And my second favorite, an Austin Powers reference here, the commercial jingle for Meow Mix. Sharrock and reports by The Guardian reported the most two common genres of music were metal and country, but the view was because they were very much American genres and that the detainees just couldn't handle the fact that they were being pumped with kind of Americanism. Now, Thomas Keenan, director of Human Rights Project at the Bard College, has made the quote, "It's music's capacity to take over your mind and invade your inner experience that makes it so terrifying." I'm going to finish off my three. I think for this podcast, three is a good number of examples or case studies, whatever you want to say. But I want to talk about one of the early implements of psychological warfare. Now, this is the Aztec death whistle. This has been cited as being extraordinary, and it was used exclusively in several zones of ancient Mexico, and comes from a really unusual family of Mexican sound kind of creators that are not particularly well known, but they can produce special sounds imitating animal calls and the noise of winds or storms. But if you think about the name, I'm not a great believer in spiritualism, anything like that, but I suppose when you die, what are you going to be hearing? The instrument is not a common whistle. It's not seen to be musical in any way, but it's been associated with death rituals by its decorated face of a skull and with the wind, because two examples were found in the hands of a sacrificed male skeleton. Now, here comes a pronunciation warning in front of the... right, this is an absolute pronunciation warning. Akatau Temple... I don't even know where to go with that. That's probably so wrong. If anyone's living in Mexico, let me know how bad that was. But the exact original use and purpose of the death whistle has been lost to time. There are some ancient death whistles around certain museums. They're made out of clay, but if you can find one, you're going to be lucky. Quite a lot of the death whistle usage was linked to festivals. And here comes another warning on pronunciation. The most remarkable festival in connection with Tezcatlipoca was the Toxal. I'm apologizing to to people in Mexico, Peru, you know, it's shocking what I'm saying, but I'm an uneducated guy living in in Redbridge in the United Kingdom. But this was held in the fifth month. On the day of the festival, a youth was slain who for an entire year previously had been carefully instructed in the role of being the victim. He assumed the victim's name, the garb, and the attributes of Tezcatlipoca himself. He was the earthly representative of the deity. He would carry the whistle symbolically of that deity, the Lord of the Night Wind. He made with it such a noise as the weird wind of night makes when it hurries through the streets. And that was written by Lewis Spence in Myths of Mexico and Peru, put out there in 1913. Now, research needs to be done into the effects of the sound of that death whistle. We know that when two or more similar whistles were pumped out, when the noise was pumped out at the same time, the effects were profound. These were seen to be phantom sounds. They were kind of infrasonic sounds. At times, they were too low for the human ear to detect, and they were seen to alter the state of consciousness of their victims. If you played several of these death whistles at the same time, the vibrations were so complex. But the number of frequencies and the intensity of the frequencies was so mad that they couldn't really be analysed, but that sheer feeling of dread and fear just warped out the kind of enemies of the Aztecs. An experimental dual model of this death whistle with the faces of Ectal and Mictlantli has been used to test the possibility of the two whistles being played at the same time. And the two sounds that were being generated were those of a really fierce storm, and the prolonged exposure to that and the complexity really screwed people up. So I reckon that's where we leave it for this podcast. You've heard my top three: the Aztec death whistle, the use of sound at Guantanamo Bay, and that Waco siege. A bit like the Number Station podcast, quite a whistle stop tour. There's so much more research that you can do. If you just Google any of those terms, you know, there are so many declassified documents, research papers on death whistles and stuff like that. Take a listen, take a look, scare yourself, do whatever you want to do. But for this week, that's two podcasts in 1 week. I think that's quite a good little job for the first week of this podcast being out there. I'm going to say good night and goodbye. Hopefully at these times of coronavirus, every listener, everyone is keeping safe. As our government is saying, what is it, stay safe or stay alert or stay at home or wear red socks? I don't even know anymore. But I'm going to edit this one down and push it out. I will be back next week. I've been in touch with a few people about interviews. Things are looking good. So, yeah, I am looking forward to growing this podcast. But, stay safe, people. Adios.